Hi, I'm Jonathan Rasmussen, and this is the Agile Uprising Podcast.
Greetings and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising Podcast. I'm your host again. Here you are, stuck with me again, Jay Hersko. And this episode, we are going to have a very great conversation. We are going to be discussing the book Competing with Unicorns, which I am going to say in a bold statement. This is the first book I've seen that represents the post-Agile, post-Scrum world. And discussing this book, we have Jonathan Rasmussen, the author himself. Jonathan, thank you for joining us.
Hi, glad to be here.
So for people who may not be familiar with you, Jonathan, or your work, can you give us a quick elevator pitch intro about who you are and how you ended up with us today?
Sure. Yeah. So my name is Jonathan Rasmussen. I've been a developer most of my career, but I've done everything else from project management. I got early into Agile way back when with Kent Beck and Extreme Programming and that. But over the years, I've been a part of the community and I've just always enjoyed sort of continuing the practice and helping people deliver software. So that's kind of how I got here today.
Perfect. And for those listeners that may recognize Jonathan's name, he wrote the book that I probably plagiarized the most in The Agile Samurai. There is a page in The Agile Samurai where Jonathan lays out the three reasons why waterfall doesn't work in a world of complexity. And if I'm going to quote off the top of my head, it's you'll never know everything. Everything you learn will inevitably change and there will always be more work than time and money will allow. So Jonathan, I definitely owe you at least like a half of my 401k, if not more,
for
royalties on that one. And I ended up finding this book. I was just bouncing around Amazon looking at Agile books and I came across this. And I said, okay, well, let me give it a shot because, and like I said in the intro, to me, this is the first book I've seen, the opening salvo in the post-Agile world. I think you used that word once, maybe twice in the book, which just goes to show that, what we're doing is quite ubiquitous to the point where do we really even need to put a name on it? It's just doing, right? It's not a special practice anymore. It's just what should be done. You know, it's like changing your underwear every day. It's just one of those things we're expected to do. And you make there's a quote early on in the book. I think it's page 3 where you have a one-liner that I thought was really impactful. No longer is software development about time, dates, and budget. Now it's all about customer impact and learning. Can we talk about that for a second from your perspective?
Yeah, absolutely, Jay. It's such a good lead-in because, I mean, software for so many years has been, you know, disrupting and eating the world that for a large part of the time, starting with big companies, it was really a means of automation, you know, particular back office systems. So we would start off automating what we already knew how to do, and that led to super productivity increases right across the board in the working world. And we owe a lot to software for doing that. But as software evolved and as it started getting more into product and development, we really saw a shift in what some of these unicorns or startups would do in that they didn't just have back office systems to automate. What they were really doing was trying to use software as a means of creating entire new products. And that really requires a completely different mind shift in terms of thinking about delivery. No longer are you just automating what you already know how to do, but you really have to get out there and discover what the customer wants. So that's a big mind shift. And when companies look to these unicorns and try to emulate them, that's the biggest difference I see in their ways of thinking is they're trying to automate something or they're trying to build something that they know how to do, but they can't quite get there because their way of thinking doesn't quite match what it needs to be.
It's almost like it's not, I don't want to say an expired mental model, but they're not aware for the ability to do things in a different way. Right. I mean, yeah. I think Michael Hammond talks about this a lot in his book where how learning and development happens, where you need to open your mind to the idea that there is a different way of doing things or looking at things. And then once you create that space can then be filled by new ideas, which is by your experience in a lot of these startups that sounds like they got there quicker than some of our larger enterprise scale IT shops and operations.
Yeah, and the ironic thing is that, you know, software is a necessary evil for a lot of companies. I mean, it just enables them to do so much more, but it is also so risky from their point of view because it is expensive. It takes a lot of money to develop these things. But the ironic thing is that every big company in the world, that there was once a startup itself. And a lot of people forget that. And as these companies grow, they lose that muscle that made them successful with the founders in the first place, which was with hustle, going out there, you know, really sitting down with customers, discovering what they wanted to do. They had to be very reactive. They had to have huge feedback funnels coming in and be able to adapt to that. As companies naturally grow and set up established product lines, they lose that ability. So that's one ironic thing, I think. And it's not that the way that we automate back office systems and do what I call in the book enterprise software development is bad. It's just there's a time and a place for it. If you know exactly what you need to do because you've been doing it for years, then go ahead and automate that using all the systems that we have at our disposal to do that. I think we've gotten much better at that over the last, say, 40 or 50 years. But if you're going to build or create something new, that requires a different mindset. Everything from incentives to how you want to put responsibility and accountability out there. And it's really that mind shift that's really important to optimize, not the budget or the timeline or the schedule, but really what you're optimizing is something completely different, which is learning, which isn't something a lot of big companies and enterprises are really geared towards because they punish mistakes and failure. So that's a really big mind shift difference. And that's something these unicorns do very, very well compared to the bigger enterprise companies.
And I think why some of the enterprise companies fail at that, Jonathan, it goes back to the point you initially made when we started this conversation, is every company started as a startup at some point. And when you have enterprise size orgs that have been around for, you know, some companies have been around for over 100 years. That's a memory that is not even, you know, if you look at the human saculum is 80 years, right? The average human lifetime. There's not even anyone alive who remembers when it was a startup. Yeah. And that is, you know, that leads to complacency, that leads to bureaucracy, all that, you know, iron law of institutions. And to your point about startups, another one of the one-liners early on in the book that I thought was really, really insightful is startups are trying to outlearn the competition, not be profitable. Not go public, right? That may be an Alcon effect, but startups are truly trying to learn more faster. And that's something I think that really resonated with me, because when you think about the A monster, right? The Agile monster, it's not about delivering more, you know, some consultants will tell you it's about delivering more value faster, cheaper, blah, blah. It's really about learning, right? It all comes down to learning.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's such a big point. You know, especially in tech, like when you look at what really a lot of these big unicorns really fear is that their worst nightmare is turning into exactly the thing they're trying to displace, which is these large established players. Like, how do we keep ourselves from becoming the, you know, the future, you know, IBMs or the, you know, someone that's not very agile, that can't react to changes in the marketplace? How do we do that? And you'll see a lot of emphasis put inside these companies on maintaining that startup mentality. Now, why do they do that? It's not just about keeping foosball tables around and serving lunch. Their greatest fear is them losing their edge and staying ahead of that next couple of guys and girls in the garage that could come along and displace them. They're very aware of that because that's where they come from. So they work very hard internally on culture, organizational structure, communication patterns. How do we keep that startup mentality as we grow and scale? And that's a huge, huge challenge that I saw firsthand at Spotify as they were growing and bringing on, you know, almost doubling their workforce every year. It's very hard to maintain that. So they put a lot of time and energy into thinking about how do we keep that startup mentality? How do we enable people to work in this way as if they own the product so we can get all the benefits that come from them?
And we're going to talk about it a little later, but you actually talk about it in the book, how a big part of them maintaining that hunger, right? Maintaining that intellectual curiosity and maintaining that startup state of mind, I really do think comes from, and you talk about it in the book, it comes from how you treat your people and how you empower your people. But before we even get to that point, you talk early on about what's colloquially known as the North Star, right? The mission concept, right? And I'd like to talk a little bit about that. And then I'd also like to talk about what you've seen, you know, the idea of a mission in a startup versus the idea of a mission in an enterprise space. And how do we, for a lot of our listeners who do work and consult and coach in the enterprise world, how do we get them, what suggestions can we give to get them thinking more like a startup and less like a well-established industry player?
Yeah, I think, you know, any of us who've worked in industry for a while know how flat a hollow mission can land when we're at a big company. I mean, we've seen the platitudes, and we'll see everyone say we put customers first and we really care what X, Y, and Z. But then when it comes to the actions of how the company actually operates, if those don't align, you feel it very quickly, and you kind of, maybe you don't lose faith, but you just don't think about the North Star or why you're really there and what you're ultimately trying to do. It's very easy to do, and I'm sure many of your listeners have experienced that. When companies get the North Star right, it's really pervasive throughout the company in lots of different ways. It's what the leaders talk about when they hold town halls and bring everyone together. It comes through in the form of, maybe we'll talk about this later, bet lists or priorities that the company sets up for the year. It comes through in how they organize themselves and the language they use, the metrics they collect, and you're constantly reminded in a good way about why we're here, what we're trying to do, and that can really cut through a lot of the cruft and help simplify the decision-making process. Because if you can line things up with your North Star and you can rally people around that, it's not only does it help build great product, it attracts the right people who are really also motivated and passionate and interested in that same mission. So it's a great recruiting tool also.
While we're discussing missions, right, you kind of sidestep into the bane of, I think, any people manager's corporate existence. It's the whole budgeting and planning cycle, right? My best friend is an agile coach at an enterprise sized company. I think it's like 30, 40,000 people. And he was just, you know, we were having a Zoom happy hour and he was remarking to me half drunkenly about how he watched his entire company lose what amounts to probably a month and a half, 45 days of total productivity, if you added up all the time everybody spent trying to do the budget for the next year. And we all know no one ever stops at the end of 2021 and says, hey, here was our budget at the beginning of 2021. Were we right? Were we wrong? Where do we adjust? We keep doing these things over and over again. It's almost like the Einsteinian definition of insanity, right? You do the same thing over and over again and you expect different results. We waste all this time worrying about, you know, budget and headcount where we really should be worrying about, to your point, the mission. What are we trying to accomplish? How much can we actually spend to get us there? And then everything else just comes along with it. And I know it sounds kind of flighty, but again, with the startup mentality, I kind of think that's the way these enterprise companies need to start thinking.
Yeah, I'll be careful. I don't want to get too started on annual budgets because this is a real hot button of mine, but I'll completely agree. It's one of the, I think, greatest forms of dysfunction that we have. And I understand why annual budgets there. I mean, when you take, you know, why companies exist and how they need to plan and how they need to operate, it really starts at the top, you know, with the CEO of a publicly traded company. What they're really about is they're the chief expectation setting officer. They have to set expectations on how they think their company is going to grow, how it's going to forecast, and whether it's quarterly results in the stock market, you know, it can, at its worst, it leads to a whole bunch of short-term, very poor short-term incentives. And it's really an expectation-setting exercise. But from the CEO down, it comes through from the price of the stock to how the company is going to perform. Then you need a budget. Then budgets need to be allocated within the company. So just imagine you're a company and you're competing with Netflix, a Spotify, or someone like that. And a year in advance, you have to predict what you're going to build, how much it's going to cost, what features are going to be included in it, the team that you're going to need to assemble, and what the expected outcomes could be. A year in advance, this is the annual budgeting process. Let's say you submit that, and then a year later, lo and behold, a bag of money falls in front of you. Now, unfortunately, of course, things have changed, but you've already committed to this thing, so you've got to execute on it now. Mm-hmm. So now you take this bag of money, but of course, the market's changed, the technology's changed, the team's changed, the expertise has changed, the language has changed, the goals have changed, maybe not, but this is what you're told to execute to. And this is so important that what we're going to do is we're going to hire an army of professionals to manage this budget as it comes through. We're going to call them project managers. I myself have been a professional project manager.
Yep.
Guilty. And their chief job now is to shepherd this thing through the company. So they're going to hire an expensive person like you or me to manage this thing, to create the charts, to allocate, to report, to create red, green, blue traffic light and report up on how we're doing. And the time and the energy these companies are putting into managing expectations, Jay, it's not even a fair fight. When they go up against these tech unicorns who are executing, building product, you know, learning, iterating, focusing relentlessly on what they're trying to do for their customers to make their lives easier, it's not even a fair fight. Like, they can't even keep up. So Advantage big enterprise, yes, established product line, yes, established customers. But in terms of looking forward in the future, getting disrupted, yeah, like absolutely it's going to happen. Mm-hmm. What I find a lot of these big companies do, and I'm almost over, is instead of trying to innovate or create new product because they know they're really tough at it, they'll just outsource that entire thing and go acquire startups. And sure, that's a complete viable strategy. As a huge company, I don't have to worry about buying product. I can go try to acquire a startup that I see coming down the tracks that could disrupt me, but that's tough. That's a big risk to take, because what if they don't want to sell? What if they don't want to be bought? Or they're just growing so quickly that they quite frankly don't need you.
Right. Or what if you buy them and it turns out, that's great. And what if they buy them and then their product, you know, the left turn that they made, they should have made a right turn. Right. And it becomes inviable. I think the concern around, you know, I think it comes from Beyond Budgeting, where I think Bjarks talks about how, you know, a budget is used as three things. It's used as a forecast, it's used as a resource allocation plan, and I forget the third thing. And that is where we consistently get held up, is those three things should all be split, right? They shouldn't all be lumped together. And while I have you on, Jonathan, for any of our listeners, if somebody knows anyone at the Gold Rat Institute that wants to come on and talk about throughput accounting, I have recently read the book and I am convinced that this will save us so much time and effort. Because like you said, Jonathan, we do need budgets, right? And we do need that, but we should spend maximize the amount of work not done. We should spend the minimal amount of time possible creating these things. Because like you said, we know they're just going to change.
Yeah.
You had a getting away from budgeting. Now we're out of our blood pressure is up early in the morning. You have another quote here, which I thought was really wild. When you start getting into the teams, where you said, "Be autonomous, but don't sub-optimize," and that was what I actually highlighted that twice. I think that was in like the Pac-Man font, because I think that's something that it's a balance that people don't think about. Whether, you know, you have a coach running around saying you're going to create autonomous teams, but sometimes in the act of creating autonomy, you're actually suboptimizing your individual components.
Yeah. And this is where that North Star, or the, you know, how do we align the company? Absolutely. We do want each of these squads or teams to be independent, to be fully accountable and responsible for what they're delivering. But what if what two squads are delivering either slightly conflicts or doesn't completely align, or just priorities change? I mean, the squad might need to, they're maintaining features in production, so they want to obviously improve and iterate on what they're doing. But what if something else that's really important for the company comes up? How do we align around that? And that's where that phrase comes in, is we want you to be autonomous, like own what you're doing, create your own work, think for yourselves, and take full responsibility for what you're delivering. But at the same time, realize there's a greater good out there. And sometimes we're going to need you to put your submission on hold, or what your purpose is, and help us move this bigger rock. And that's what the don't sub-optimize means. Sometimes you just got to put your stuff on hold and help out for the greater good.
Right. It's the needs of, quoting Spock, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the team, right? The needs of the one.
Yeah.
And you actually have there's another line in here where it says, where you define autonomous, whereas being able to take that longer term view and to empower teams to balance the countless trade-offs that come with delivery. So, right. So I, that to your point, that's us as a team standing up and saying, you know what, we really want to get this feature done. However, there's this other thing coming that we know is going to be much more beneficial to the overall company. It better aligns with the mission. Let's take a step back for our own selves to go this way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I'm going to go into one of the other call outs in this book, that this is why, again, I think we're talking post-Agile here. You start talking about squads, you know, there's squads, tribes, chapters, and guilds, the whole Spotify organizational model. And you make a remark where squads are staffed only by people doing the work. Okay, well, that makes total sense. And then a little further down, you start talking about how there are no Scrum Masters there because unicorns don't do Scrum. And I read that and I stopped and I started thinking and I went, I think he's right. Yeah. Can we expound on that a little bit?
Yeah.
For someone, and I'll be honest, Jonathan, we do have some listeners who are very new to the Scrum and Agile space. So you're kind of explaining, you know, the New Testament as they've just picked up the Old Testament. Let's unpack that a little bit.
Yeah. So when I wrote the book and knowing the background I've got from Agile Samurai, that I know there'd be a lot of Scrum Masters out there reading this, and I didn't want to upset everyone by basically saying these tech companies aren't doing, you know, textbook Scrum, but it's true. But I also want to highlight that, you know, Spotify got a lot from Agile and Scrum. That was the initial model that they brought in. And the big reason and the benefit that Scrum, I think, brought to a place like Spotify was they needed to accelerate the learning on their teams very quickly. They wanted to ramp up fast. So they started, you know, doing Scrum, having Scrum Masters, but then they did what every company should do when adopting Scrum or Agile, is they made it their own. They found that role of Scrum Master, while initially really helpful, once people understood the basics of how Agile worked, it really wasn't required anymore. So they kind of dropped that role. And they kind of took it and they morphed it into the Agile organizational model you mentioned, which there's lots of great videos on there by Henrik Knieberg and others. Mm-hmm. But basically, when you listen to interviews on Amazon and Facebook and now Spotify and other places, it's not textbook Scrum where they're hiring Scrum Masters and they get together and do, you know, textbook daily standups and things like that. They've morphed it into something else. There's even a bigger difference I noticed when I first went to Spotify. Just a short story. I'd been there about 6 months. I was on the highest priority, for lack of a better term, initiative that they had at the time. And that was bringing Spotify to the Sony PlayStation. And it was not going well. I was the coach on the team. We were behind schedule. We had an all hands. And I said, hey, everyone, I don't think we're going to make this deadline. And this is a hard deadline. Like, Sony was going to turn off their music service on this date and we needed to be there. Like, there was no moving the deadline. So I said, hey, I've been tracking how the team's doing. I don't think we're going to make it. And I just kind of rolled that hand grenade out of the table. I stepped back expecting it to blow up. And then I heard crickets. The program director turned to me, Osa, and she said, well, Jonathan, thank you for sharing that information. We're going to trust the team delivering to reach out if they need help and we'll let them handle it. And I was like, oh my God, like what just happened here? This was not the reaction I was expecting, you know, fists pounding the table. This is unacceptable. How are we going to do this? Rally the troops, panic, panic, hair on fire, as I would have seen at other enterprises and companies I've worked with in the past. But no, that didn't happen. So they wrapped up the all hands. I'm walking out of the room and I'm going, what just happened there? And I looked around and I go, why have I not heard the word budget since I've been here in 6 months? And I looked around some more and I said, where's the project manager? Like I was a project manager and like I kind of came here, I'm doing some coaching, but there's no project manager. Who's doing the project management? I looked around and I said, this is really weird. And that was the first itch or scratch that I said, these guys are doing something very different. Things are getting delivered. Project management's getting done, but not by a project manager. But wait a minute, they're not even doing these things called projects. How are these guys delivering without budgets, project managers, and projects? I'm not saying that to piss off all the project managers out there, of which I was one, but it was just very, very different. So going back to the Scrum Master, going back to the project manager, to try to cut through all that, they're just very, very focused on delivery. And maybe we'll roll into the company bets discussion, which I think is a great, great, great topic in itself. But basically, they just find ways of aligning teams, creating a small autonomous teams, trying to keep that startup mentality, and then aligning them around these North goals or company bets, and then delivering and not panicking the way we normally would when it comes to budgets and scopes and things like that. So it's different. I mean, I think now if I go back to Spotify, you would see some project managers there in different parts of the organization, like legal and human resources and that. But tech, product, and design, where I was at the time, just didn't have them. They organized in different ways.
And the postscript to that story, actually, I think you talk about it in the book, where the team did actually make the deadline and it ends up working out perfectly.
I was completely surprised. And I did not think that was going to go down at all. When they flipped the switch on that morning, I think it was March 11th, and everything worked, and they had the war room, and they had all the machines around the world, Germany, Japan, US, people turning on their PlayStations and Spotify appearing. I was like, wow, was I ever wrong there? Now there's a lot more I could say on that, but yeah, that was a good moment. They proved me wrong. They did deliver, but I'll just also say we did some tech debt to pay down after.
That's to be expected, right? But that ties to another remark you make in the book about, and I know Daniel Mezick has talked about this. I know Jürgen Apollo talks about this in Management 3.0, which is lowering the decision-making floor, right? Push decisions down as far as you can. That allows teams to self-organize and the word you used was trust themselves, and the management trusted this team. That's what happens when you give them a little bit of space in that regard. And I'm convinced that they'll never not surprise you. And that proves that that team was empowered and they got the results that were.
Jay, I just want to touch on that, because you just hit on what is really the essence of the entire book to me, which is empowerment and trust. And I was going to say that to the end, but I'll just touch on it here. How would you feel if you went to work and every excuse you had for not delivering was taken away? Like, need a faster computer? Here you go. Don't like the plan? Change it. Think we're working on the wrong thing? Can you set the priority? Don't like the work? Well, we'll give you the mission, but you create the work. Like, when you get up in the morning and you look in the mirror and every excuse that you used to put in front of yourselves, like, I told management what to do. They're not listening to me. I don't have great equipment. No one's taking my advice. I don't feel empowered to bring about this architectural change or bring about these suggestions. When they take away every excuse you've got, what are you left with? Nothing. It's on you. Yeah. It's on you. So if you're going to fail, okay, you can fail, but it's not, you can't blame it on anyone else.
Right.
And that's what's so great about these enterprises. They give us excuses to fail, basically, because either they don't listen, they don't heed our recommendations. I'm not accountable. I said it's going to take 6 months. They gave me 3. All right, it's not my date anymore.
Right, not my
I'm
fault.
I'm accountable.
Yep, I didn't make this plan
last year, but I don't own that. So yeah, okay, I'll do my best. Yeah, we'll give it our all, but no, that's not going to happen. So
I didn't make this plan. I didn't sign up for it yet.
You're
right. It's a very fascinating. And I ask our listeners to, pause this episode and think about if all the excuses that, not even excuses, of all the rationales, of all the reasons that you have for when your last project that didn't go well, if you took those away, where would that leave you? And it's a really, some would say frightening, some would say exciting, but it does, it puts you in a completely different mental state. That it'd be fascinating to see what some of these companies could do if they actually did that. Pretty powerful. So you've hinted at it a couple of times. Let's talk, Jonathan, about your idea of bets and dibs. Cause I thought it's not something so complex that you need like a 16 page book to understand, but I thought this was very interesting, laying things out in plain English.
Yeah. Yeah. This to me is one of the greatest things. And Spotify, I don't think came up with this. I think they took it from Google. But basically, how do you move really big rocks organizationally in the company with teams right across the organization? Like, that's a really, really tough thing. And I credit Agile with coming along. We've gotten very good at delivering, smaller, for lack of a better term, projects with small autonomous teams. Great. We're really good at taking that system, automating with that team. We're really good at working like this. But how do you do something across the organization? Something that involves teams from legal, from the login or the back office to the front end to the legacy database or whatever. How do you coordinate and bring all these people together? And so what these tech companies do is they basically create these things called a bet list. And it's basically a prioritized list where if we can do these, 5 or 6 things this year, we're gonna have a very good year. And these are the biggest, most impactful things that the leadership of the company have come up with. So for example, at Spotify, it was things like getting Spotify into the Sony PlayStation. That was a huge bet, a huge opportunity that came to Spotify, but it required teams right across the organization. So how do you do that? So basically what Spotify did was they create this bet list. Number one, Sony PlayStation. Number two, Google Chromecast. Number three, you know, Japan launch. And then when it comes to quarterly planning, they ask all their teams to line up their work, if they can, with a big bet. So if there's something you can do to help move along the Sony PlayStation project, please make yourself available, identify the work you need to do to help make that happen. If you can't, then go down to the next thing on the list. Maybe it's, you know, the Japan launch. So if you can help with the Japan launch, you know, please do. Maybe there's some new backend systems we need to do, some localization and some things. Line up your work towards that and keep going down the list until there's really, there might not be something that you need to do in this, you know, top 10 corporate list, because you've got your own mission as a squad yourself. You might be in charge of winning music in the home. So that was a squad where basically what we wanted to make, you know, the TV, the radio, the speakers, that was the hardware squad I was on. That was our mission, to make all that work. But if we could work or help a company-wide bet, we would put our work on hold to help out. And that, in a nutshell, in a very, very simple way, without requiring tons of committees, you know, entirely new org structures, entirely new budgets, this is the fluidity that these tech companies use in terms of letting their teams kind of self-organize, figure out where they can help out the most, and then go back to their day-to-day jobs after that.
Which is brilliant, right? Because lot of teams, you know, like back to our blood pressure increasing budgeting, right? They get a list of these are the things we need to work on, and they set that list, and it's a fire and forget missile. It's not really guided. And what if something comes up? Then you're got your head down, you know, you're looking straight down as you're plowing into the iceberg.
And Jay, it's even bigger than that. It's incentives, right? Like think of the traditional organizational structure. Who came up with that term company ship software according to how they're organized? If I'm the Metcalf, I think, I can't remember.
It's kind of like a Conway's law.
Thank you. If I have an entire product division and say we're just responsible for the back end of this enterprise, I'm going to have my goals that I need to deliver this year done. Then you're going to have, say, a mobile team over here that's got a mobile, you know, product that they serve for the customers. But those are two different fiefdoms. And the mobile guys, or the, you know, the people building the front end of the website, they can't do anything without the back office changes. But if you've got those as separate teams with different incentives, how are they going to align? Like, it's a really long process. The mobile team or the web team has to make a request to the back office team. Mm-hmm. Hey guys, we need a change made to the account management system so that we can display, you know, what the bill would be like in a 3-month, you know, rolling kind of format. Can you guys do that? Yeah, we'll get to that, you know, maybe next year. Like, because they're not aligned. They've got different incentives. Mm-hmm. They've got different definitions of success. They all want to get promoted and help protect their own, you know, fight drums. There's no incentive for me to help you in another part of the organization. And this company,
that's a great line.
That's exactly it.
Yep.
There's no incentive for it. The incentives are all wrong. And that's why these big enterprises move so slow. Like, these tech companies are just executing circles around them, because these tech companies, they don't have those fiefdoms. Like, our goal, our mission is to get more people listening to music right now and enable a million creators to make a livelihood off creating music. That's it. Mm-hmm. So you align with that, and we're not here to protect, you know, this fiefdom or this, you know, headcount or see how great I can grow. The other thing these tech companies do is they continuously, like, I don't want to make it sound like chaos, but they blow up their organizations more often than not.
Yeah.
Meaning they will restructure. If I'm the head of a tribe and I'm a tribe lead, my tribe could drastically change or shrink or grow. I might be 60. We might grow to 150. Now we need to break that apart because it's getting too big. So another tribe will exist with another tribal leader who mm-hmm. was a developer before, and they want to try doing some management, some leadership. Okay. Like, you don't have that legacy, and you don't have that protectionism that you sometimes see in these big companies where, well, what's good for you right now may not be good for me. So we'll get to you when we can. But right now I've got this other thing I'm going to work on. So,
and I think we could probably, this is definitely a topic for another episode. We could unpack the whole incentive idea for probably hours, right? Because most practitioners, most coaches, anybody who's done software delivery, you know, even an old, like, you know, like an RUP guy or a CMMI guy will tell you that most of it is, it's always around to misplace incentives and misplace motivation. Yes. You know, good intentions, you know, paves the road to hell, all that sort of stuff. But moving on to more positive stuff. There are one or two things I'd like to call out before we start wrapping up. You introduced the idea of, which I love, the idea of a productivity squad.
Oh yeah.
And this, when I read this, my brain first thought, okay, so my first thought was like the integration team and like Nexus or even like a system team in Safe. But then I started digging in and it's more like a proto center of practice along with one of those things. And I really think that if to our enterprise listeners, if your company is serious about getting better, more efficient, this is the place you got to go. This is the way you got to go.
Yeah. I mean, the wrong way to do this is to have a standards and architecture team at your enterprise and have them go around with the hammer to all the teams and say, you will do this, you will do that. You know, I understand that sometimes you need to enforce, you know, standards and architecture, but that's not what this is. This productivity squad thing you're talking about, these are people you're actually really happy to see show up at your front door because their mission is to make you go faster. It's all about speed, increasing the ability to iterate, to learn, to figure out better, run more experiments, figure out what the customer truly wants. So they show up and, you know, you're building product, you're maintaining something in production. There could be a laundry list of stuff you know you'd like to do to enable yourselves to go faster. Everything from better tooling to smoothing out the deployment process to writing, you know, better merge or tools just help you work together. This team shows up and says, how can we help? How can we make your lives easier? And it's everything from if you need a new, you know, instance of a server, something in the cloud, well, they'll automate that process for you. They'll create a page that you can just go to that says, if you need a new instance of Hudson or a new Google Cloud instance, just type these commands in your command line, boom, you've got it. And you're like, wow, I didn't have to fill out a form. I didn't have to get permission. If there's just something you need,
right?
They just try to make it go faster. If deployment's taking a long time, let us handle that. They'll build up a complete pipeline that will take a commit, you know, run the test, report back what's not working, merge all the other changes in at the same time, build that, you know, artifact at the very end, and then send a notification up that says, hey, everyone, there's a new build that's ready to go for regression. Let's take a look at it. Their mission, their incentive is to make you go faster. And I do not see any enterprise teams do this. If anything, they slow you down. And the other aspect this comes to, Jay, is trust. Mm-hmm. These tech companies trust their people. I mean, how many times have I shown up at a company where I've gotten a laptop where I don't have any permission set? They're asking me to change, you know, my password, you know, once a week. I can't even go to some social sites. They're blocked because they think I'm going to waste my time watching.
Yeah,
I've been in a website where I couldn't even access my own agile and a nutshell.com website because it said, this is like bad for you. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, you've just communicated. We have no trust in you as an individual or a human. So we'll treat you like that. It's like, oh, it's so frustrating.
And when you treat people like that, it becomes a self-reinforcing circle, right? It's not great for man. I mean, let's be honest, it's not great for management. It's not great for the leadership tier. It's not great for the people who just the rank and file. And I think that brings us to, I know we're quickly coming up on time. So the closeout quote that I picked for this episode is actually directly from the book and you just hit on it. I thought this was really, really, really powerful. And the quote is, tech companies don't have better people than traditional companies. They simply empower and trust them more. And when I read that, there's like, I have it highlighted. There's a red marker all the way around it because I honestly think that sums it all up in a nutshell, right? The startup mentality gives people the runway to achieve. And then they go and they achieve. And then that becomes a self-repeating prophecy, right? And a self-fulfilling prophecy, as opposed to, you need to fill out 6 different forms to get access to agileonanutshell.com.
Yeah. I mean, that to me was really the secret sauce. I don't want to say like Google doesn't have some world-class engineers or Facebook doesn't hire, you know, super smart talent, but the vast majority of people that I've worked with and seen working at these companies are regular people who are given a lot of, you know, trust and empowerment, and it really elevates their game and really makes them want to deliver because now they're the ones controlling their own destiny. And like I said, all the excuses, when you take all the excuses away and you're left with nothing else but yourself and your ability with your team to deliver, you can't help but want to deliver because what's the alternative? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Like, what's it, like, not deliver, like, not try? Like, no, right. Everyone wants to try and do good works. They show up every day. This is my show. I have a say in how this works. I'm going to do my darndest to make it happen. And it just leads to incredible, incredible results. And the reason why I wrote this book is I want more people to be aware of this, because I'm hoping this becomes more of a norm in terms of how we work. Because I love working this way. I see more enterprises looking at this now and realizing that this is a powerful thing. So I really hope it catches on and it just gets bigger.
Perfect. Perfect. That's no better way to wrap it up. So, Jonathan, if users want to get in touch with you, we're obviously going to have a link to the book to purchase. If users want to get in touch with you, they want to find out more, maybe investigate or dig into some of your other work. Where could they find you? How should they contact you? All that sort of questions.
Yeah, I think Twitter's great. Jay Rasmussen at Twitter is super. And if you just Google, I've got a website, agilewarrior.com. You'll see a lot of iOS development on there, as that's what I'm currently working on. But absolutely, please fire me a question. Do check out the book, and I hope it helps you in the workplace.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank Jonathan. On behalf of myself and the listeners, I want to thank Jonathan for taking his time early this morning to sit down with us. Rare non-evening recording for us. On behalf of Jonathan and myself, I want to thank all of you listeners for tuning in again. Once again, if you enjoyed the episode, give us a rating, a review, leave comments, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Audible, your podcast platform of choice. It does help other listeners find us. If you enjoyed this episode and you want to get into the conversation, we have a very, very, very vibrant Discord server with, surprisingly, and I'll be the first one to be surprised, an international footprint. So just because you're listening overseas or across the pond doesn't mean you might actually connect with someone who actually works next door. And last but not least, we are always committed to making these shows free. But if you like what you hear and you want to contribute, we do have a Patreon. I will throw it in the show notes. You might actually get a surprise in the mail from me. Once again, on behalf of Jonathan and myself, I want to thank you all for listening. And until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast signing out.